From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, clashes erupt in Israel after a 17-year-old Palestinian is killed in a suspected revenge attack following the murder of three Israeli teenagers.
We call on the government of Israel and the Palestinian Authority to take all necessary steps to prevent an atmosphere of revenge and retribution.
Also today, the latest from our correspondent in Iraq as strange bedfellows emerge in the fight against the Islamist rebels. And after 30 years apart, Monty Python reunite to mixed reviews. But the fans are in no doubt.
Fantastic, absolutely brilliant.
Did they deliver?
Oh yes, they delivered. It was awesome.
110%.
Wonderful, as good as 40 years ago when I saw them live at Drury Lane.
Absolutely fantastic, worth the wait.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Israeli officials are calling for calm after the body of a Palestinian teenager was found on Wednesday morning, sparking fierce clashes in East Jerusalem. 17-year-old Mohammed Abu Qader was last seen being forced into a car in what Palestinians say may have been a revenge attack following the murder of three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. The Palestinian youngster will be buried on Thursday. U.S. officials called his killing a heinous murder, as FSN's Lorna Shaddock reports from Washington.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest told reporters on Wednesday that the killing of the 17-year-old, which follows the discovery of three Israeli teenagers' bodies on Monday, is a despicable act. But the White House also stressed it doesn't want to see the situation spiral out of control.
We call on the government of Israel and the Palestinian Authority to take all necessary steps to prevent an atmosphere of revenge and retribution.
Mr. Earnest wouldn't say whether the U.S. considers Mohammed Abu Qader's death an act of revenge for the murder of the three Israeli teenagers. He simply cautioned against further violence. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
A ship containing what has been declared the last of Syria's chemical weapons has docked in Italy. The deadly material will be transferred to a U.S. vessel for the chemicals to be destroyed. From FSN's bureau at the UN in New York, William Denzelow reports.
Mustard gas and components of nerve agent VX and sarin will be taken into international waters, where the bulk of the material will be neutralised. Remaining chemicals not destroyed on the US ship are expected to be buried on land in specific facilities. William Denslow, New York.
Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says he hopes his country's parliament will be able to form a new government, despite deep divisions. His comments in a weekly televised address came just a day after parliament's first session since April elections ended in chaos. FSN's Ollie Barrett, on special assignment in Iraqi Kurdistan, says few people there share the Prime Minister's optimism.
There are still major divisions and there are still severe doubts among many Iraqi politicians that Nouri al-Maliki is genuinely serious about forming a government that is in any way inclusive of the various parties that are so divided now in Iraq.
The defending Wimbledon champion Andy Murray has been defeated in the quarterfinals of the tournament by Bulgaria's Grigor Dimitrov. The 23-year-old 11th seed won the match in straight sets. It's the first time since 2008 that Murray has failed to reach the final four. He told reporters he had only himself to blame.
I mean, I started the tournament well. I was playing good tennis and today was a bad day. You know, from my side, I made many mistakes and then started going for too much and taking chances that weren't really there.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The former French president Nicolas Sarkozy says the country's judiciary is being used for political ends. He was speaking to French television after being placed under formal investigation for influence peddling. From FSN's Europe desk in Brussels, Sandra Gutman reports.
Well, Mr. Sarkozy's appearance on French television trying to dispel these accusations of influence peddling and thwarting the French judicial system really underlines the level of effort he's putting into trying to salvage his reputation at the moment. It's an unprecedented move in France. No former president has been detained like this by police before. He's now been released, of course, and is still not formally charged, but Mr. Sarkozy insists the damage has somehow already been done, that there are forces at play trying to harm his political career, and is now reaching out to the French public himself.
Facebook's number two executive Sheryl Sandberg has apologized for the social network's secret psychological tests. Revelations about the experiment on nearly 700,000 users in 2012 have prompted a fierce backlash. From FSN's bureau in San Francisco, Rebecca Bowering reports.
We never meant to upset you. Sheryl Sandberg, deputy to Facebook's CEO Mark Zuckerberg, apologized to users for poor communication regarding what she called ongoing research to test different products. The statement shows Facebook backing down after it insisted on Tuesday that its mass experiment was covered by its terms of service. The 2012 study tweaked users' news feeds to test exposure to positive and negative emotional content. The manipulation of information has been condemned as creepy and disturbing by lawyers, web activists, and users themselves. Facebook only added a research clause to its terms and conditions 4 months after the experiment took place.
Interact with us on Twitter. We are there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
There continues to be ongoing security cooperation between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government. And I certainly want to, the United States certainly would encourage both sides to remain engaged in that cooperation. I would also point out that we've also seen statements from people like Prime Minister Netanyahu, who said earlier today that people should not take the law into their own hands. So we want to see both sides acting responsibly to this situation to ensure that it doesn't spiral out of control and lead to even further tragic violence.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest today in reaction to violent clashes in Israel triggered by the discovery of a murdered Palestinian teenager. It's feared the death of the 17-year-old was a revenge attack for the murder of three Jewish Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. Tom Rayner is the Middle East correspondent for Sky News and gave this update earlier today.
Palestinian residents of the area of Shufat and also the neighbourhood of Beit Hanina are currently clashing with Israeli police. This follows the discovery of a body said to be of a Palestinian teenager in an area of the Jerusalem forest, which is in West Jerusalem. Now, that body was discovered at around 5 a.m. and Israeli police are now trying to establish whether there is a connection between the body that was found and a call that they received at around 4 a.m. local time, claiming that an Arab teenager had been dragged into the back of a car in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Beit Hanina. Now, they said that they cannot make the formal connection between that reported abduction and the body that was discovered, but there is big speculation in the Palestinian media, at least, that this was the body of the teenager that was seen being dragged into the car. Big clashes now in the neighborhoods where he is from, Shuafat, and in Beit Hanina, where that apparent abduction took place. Israeli police have said that they have increased police levels across the city to try and prevent further escalation. This coming after last night, there were big hardline rallies across Jerusalem following the funerals of those three Israelis, calling, amongst other things, for death to the Arabs. Chants being made by hardline Israelis who want their government to react with more force and more violence in retribution, if you like, of those three Israelis. 47 people were arrested in central Jerusalem last night in relation to those protests. So real fears that this may be a reprisal action for those murders of the three Israeli teenagers. We are just arriving in the Shuafat area now near Beit Hanina, and we can see from where we are stones still being thrown at Israeli riot police, Israeli riot police holding what appear to be tear gas, grenade launchers and other things. So a very, very tense situation that still clearly is ongoing.
Tom Rayner, Middle East correspondent for Sky News, talking to Britain's LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. As Islamist fighters continue to destabilize Iraq, the country's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, today insisted a parliament can be formed. The Obama administration has once again urged Baghdad to curb the militant force in Iraq by easing sectarian tensions and forming a diverse, unified government. Over 700 US troops are now in the capital to advise the Iraqi military and carry out air surveillance missions. Helicopters and unarmed drones are also being used. Our correspondent Ollie Barrett discussed unfolding events with Alexander Whitcomb, a journalist at Rudar English in Erbil, northern Iraq. And Ollie began by asking him if the formation of a government there shows any signs of progress.
Well, when you look at the way that the last session ended, I'm not sure it is particularly likely. You have very little constructive dialogue between the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the state of law block at the moment. So, no, I don't see it happening anytime soon.
He was pretty strong as well on the Kurds, on this idea of a referendum soon in Kurdistan. Would you have expected that?
I think so. I mean, he's definitely playing to the kind of emotional reaction from his own supporters right now, but I'm not sure it's going to lead to much constructive dialogue in the near future between any of the main parties.
And on that idea of a referendum here, in the next few months, that President Barzani seems to be suggesting, how soon do you think it could take place?
Well, it'll take a while because they'll have to put together their own electoral commission. Technically, they can do the referendum, but the major question is whether the Kurds will be able to finance independence.
In what sense?
In the sense that the Kurds right now are not able to retrieve their funds from Halk Bank. So even if they're planning on funding their independence with their oil revenues, right now that's not technically possible.
And so how do we get over those obstacles? I mean, Kirkuk, for example, is now under Kurdish control.
Kirkuk is under control. Almost all of the disputed territories are under Kurdish control. And they do have some income, but at the same time, it's not enough to match what's estimated at $1.5 billion a month that they need to keep themselves going. Of course, the Peshmerga are willing to fight without pay for a long, long time, and civil servants will accept that their salaries won't come in for a while, but at the same time, Kurdistan needs to pay government employees and the economy needs to keep running. What would need to happen is you'd need to have the Americans and other international partners essentially endorse, whether publicly or privately, purchases of Kurdish oil revenue and allow Halk Bank or give Halk Bank permission to trade in U.S. dollars. Yeah.
Because potentially this is a rich country.
It is a very rich country, potentially. Kurdistan has a huge amount of oil reserves, gas reserves. They have a lot of things going for them, but they're going to need the endorsement of international players, especially the United States and Iran, in order to have independence work out.
And finally, there have been calls from the U.S. and other quarters for the Kurds to, I suppose, get more involved in the fight against ISIS or IS. Is that likely? What would be in it for the Kurds?
That's the tricky thing. I don't think it is likely for the Kurds to go and take Mosul back, for example. It's quite an emotional issue for the Kurds. They are not willing to sacrifice Peshmerga blood for the sake of a unified Iraq. And so it's going to be very difficult to cut a deal with the United States or any other player to get the Kurds go in and take military actions in the south of Iraq or beyond the disputed areas.
FSN's Ollie Barrett with Alexander Whitcomb, a journalist at Rudar English in Erbil, northern Iraq. Now, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has warned the world could soon be cast back into the dark ages of medicine if new antibiotics are not developed. Mr. Cameron has started a review into why so few antibiotic drugs have been introduced in recent years, despite the increase in resistance to them. The US President Barack Obama is among world leaders who have backed the review. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead joins us from outside the British Department of Health with more.
Well, the Prime Minister has issued a stark warning to world leaders on this issue, saying that if the world fails to act to tackle growing resistance to antibiotics, the population could be looking at an unthinkable scenario where treatable infections and injuries will kill once again. Now, he has set up a special panel to tackle this issue. It's made up of experts from science, finance, industry and global health to review the problem. He hopes that this panel will set out plans for encouraging the development of new antibiotics. And the review focuses on three key issues. Firstly, the increase in drug-resistant strains of bacteria, just why they have become more prevalent. The market failure, which has seen no new classes of antibiotics developed for more than 25 years now, and also the overuse of antibiotics globally. Now, this is a killing situation. It's estimated that drug-resistant strains of bacteria are responsible for killing one child under five every 5 minutes in Southeast Asia. In Europe, 25,000 deaths occur every year because antibiotics don't work. The UK's Chief Medical Officer for England, Professor Dame Sally Davies, says action must be taken now.
It's an arms race. We're losing it. And when we've lost it, we will lose modern medicine as we know it. Cancer treatment makes people's immune system weak. They get infections. They won't live if the antibiotics don't work.
Well, David Cameron has already garnered substantial support from world leaders on this issue. At a recent gathering of G7 leaders at a summit in Brussels, the US President Barack Obama and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel pledged specific support to the initiative. David Cameron will be hoping that this issue is high on the agenda at next year's G7 summit, which is being hosted in Germany. Dan Whitehead, London.
San Francisco's annual Pride Parade is one of the biggest and most spectacular celebrations of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender identity anywhere in the world. The theme of this year's festival was Colour the World with Pride, a message of inclusivity one of the event's grand marshals, or honorary representatives, has been trying to champion. South African-born attorney and human rights activist Melanie Nathan campaigned to bring around 20 LGBT Africans to march alongside her at the parade. But not one of the applicants was granted a visa by the US State Department. Rebecca Bowering reports from San Francisco.
An estimated million people turned out to take part. There was music, dancing, and extravagant costumes. But among the revelers, few African faces. The theme, Colour Our World with Pride, was an opportunity for advocates to call for the global decriminalisation of homosexuality. They argue sexual identity and the freedom to express it is a basic human right. South African-born activist Melanie Nathan, one of the faces of Pride 2014, has been fighting to defend LGBT people in countries such as Uganda, Cameroon and the Gambia.
Africa is criminalising homosexuality through old draconian penal codes and through new anti-homosexuality legislation. For that reason, we want to bring African voices to the United States of America to tell their stories of the resulting persecution.
Nathan originally invited 21 LGBT Africans to San Francisco to march with her contingent in the parade. She raised money on a crowdfunding website for plane tickets and accommodation, but the US State Department turned down every visa application, unconvinced the applicants would return to countries that might persecute them. This spring, Canada and Sweden also denied visas to LGBT Ugandans seeking to attend gay rights-related events. Nathan says she hoped the US might respond differently, especially since Washington recently imposed sanctions on Kampala for its anti-homosexuality stance. She's disappointed, but undeterred.
To the people in Africa, we're here marching for you. You're not criminals, you're beautiful people, just like us here in San Francisco today.
Among Nathan's contingent was a gay man from Zambia. Chalwe says he's now finally able to be himself and wishes others could enjoy the same freedom.
The best message I would send to my brothers and sisters out there is that it's okay to be who you are, irrespective of where you're born or what your family background. We are who we are, and we are all humans, and it all starts from that.
In 77 countries around the world, being LGBT is illegal.
Africa Pride!
Some of the Africans Melanie Nathan invited here are currently in hiding. She says every one of them was willing to take whatever risk was necessary to draw attention to what's happening in their countries. She calls them the true human rights defenders. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
Now, after 30 years, the legendary comedy pack Monty Python are once again at the mercy of the critics. While the press greeted their comeback performance in London last night with mixed reviews, the audience were in little doubt the arena spectacular was worth the decades-long wait. Entertainment correspondent Kevin Hughes was there.
There's a few papers, I think the Independent today is commenting that the show felt a little bit lacking in substance and material, and there's a lot of visuals with the show. There's a big production, a lot of choreography, and there's a lot of video sequences. But when you do get to see the Pythons on stage, when they are on delivering those iconic sketches, they're on form. Considering they're men in their 70s, we've waited over 30 years to see them back on stage. And you know what, Jim? They have the O2 in the palm of their hand. Obviously, standing ovation as soon as they came on stage last night. They used an image of Graham Chapman on the big screen that got like a 10-minute rapturous round of applause. You couldn't actually hear the first sketch because people were still applauding and so excited. And then, of course, at the end, when you get Eric Idle leading the big chorus of Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, everybody else on their feet last night.
And it was a very expensive production, and I think they're not doing too badly out of the run they're doing.
No, and I love the fact that they are, of course, being very honest about the desire for maybe a bit of extra cash and blocking that. In fact, there was a meter on the big screen in the interval showing how much merchandise they were selling. Obviously, a joke, but the merchandise stand, £25 a t-shirt, actually had stuff to buy, stuff for money, as a big sign over the merchandise stand. You don't see that at a Rihanna or Beyonce concert. But yes, big production, big choreography numbers, big dancers. Heavily supported, I said, with these visual sequences. And I just found once they found their pace with Act Two, they really found their feet. And with some of the bigger sketches, like the parrot sketch and Lumberjack and also the cheese sketch and all the ones you want to see in Act Two. And also a lot of ad-libbing and a lot of sort of off-the-cuff remarks. That's what the audience really reacted to. And I in fact, came out of the OT last night, Jim, had a word with fans, and this is what they told me.
Fantastic, absolutely brilliant.
Did they deliver?
Oh yes, they delivered. It was awesome.
110%.
Wonderful, as good as 40 years ago when I saw them live at Drury Lane. Very good.
They still got it?
They certainly have, yes. Wonderful.
Highlight of the night, what was it?
The Yorkshireman, I think, for me.
Second half, particularly good.
Absolutely fantastic, worth the wait.
What was the special moment?
Parrot sketch. Definitely the parrot sketch. I mean, I knew they'd do all the classics, but that was the one, you know. I wouldn't have been happy if they hadn't done that, yeah.
Actually seeing them live just opens up a whole new dimension.
Just brilliant. Palin!
Of course, didn't get a ticket because it is a sellout. There is a chance to see it. How, Kevin?
There are still some tickets available, apparently, for some of the shows. Also, there's going to be a TV broadcast of the event. And, of course, Christmas, there's bound to be a DVD. The big question is, will they bow out in 9 shows' time, or will they continue? Will they think and have the energy to carry on? We shall wait and see.
Entertainment correspondent Kevin Hughes talking to LBC Radio's Jim Diamond. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. Here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, how do you improve air quality in one of the most polluted cities on the planet? That's the challenge Mexico City is taking on after decades of urban growth. A multi-million dollar program is underway aimed at quite literally taming the city and making it not only a more enjoyable place to live, but a healthier one too. Sam Jones, global development reporter for Britain's Guardian newspaper, has been to Mexico City and he's breathed in the air.
I'm standing on a roof garden in Mexico City with Anya Peñalosa, who works for the Environmental Secretariat of Mexico City. We're surrounded by grey, lots of traffic noises and some aeroplanes, but there's a sudden stretch of green here. Anna, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, we're at the top of one of the buildings that are the offices of the Environment Department Secretary of Mexico City. And we have green roof here. It's open to all the people that work here. In this building, we have the air quality direction. So they are doing all the analysis about the air quality and monitoring of the whole city. We're actually in downtown. And it's like a lot of cars passing around all the time.
I think we can hear those.
Yeah. So this space, it's like being away from that.
What's the public reaction been? I mean, you say it serves a very useful purpose. It helps, you know, purify the air because it drags down some of the nasty gases, which there are, because there's a lot of motor vehicles in Mexico City, as we can hear loud and clear. And it's good for children. And if you work in this bit of the environment department, you can come and have exercise classes on the roof. But what's the public reaction been? What have the people who live in Mexico City, what have they told you about what the project means to them, having these green roofs?
Well, I think that in general, people is very keen. There's a lot of people growing plants and even vegetables in their available spaces at home, like some balconies or even in their rooftop. And the Environmental Education Department has a lot of these kind of projects and workshops teaching people to grow their own food. Even though there are some big parks like Chapultepec, we are trying to put and bring closer to people these green spaces. Like, for example, in hospitals, it's really important because it helps to heal people as well. And in public schools, to teach children to, like, grow plants and vegetables and have green spaces where it's available, where it's possible.
And I mean, the government's, this is one of the measures that they've put in place to try and improve the air quality. And there's a bicycle scheme similar to the Boris bikes in London or the bicycle scheme in Paris. What other steps has the government taken to try and reduce the problems of very polluted air in the city?
Well, have been implemented since the 90s, right? But of course, we believe that transportation modes, it's directly related to air quality in the city. And of course, we're working really hard on that. For example, the public bike scheme started 4 years ago, and it's been a tremendous success. And of course, people is realizing that the alternatives, like transportation alternatives, that are actually more convenient, 80% of the pollution of the city comes from vehicles. It's important that citizens realize that every action they take, it's important and it counts for, like, having a better air quality and life quality of life in general.
And you're from Mexico City. What can you describe what the pollution was like 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Yeah, it has changed. It has improved, but it's, you know, it's always more and more people living here and the city is growing, and you have to, like, monitor and control it, like, continuously.
And as a native of Mexico City, how would you rate the air quality today, this afternoon? If you look around and you big deep breath, how would you describe the air this afternoon?
I mean, it could be better. But, I mean, I'm from here, as you said, you know. It's fair enough, it's all right.
Yeah, there's noticeable smog, I think, and some of the buildings, as we get towards the sides of the valley, fade away into greens and into blues and greys, but it doesn't feel quite as bad as it was when I was last here 11 years ago. I mean, you think there's definitely been an improvement?
Yeah, when I was a child, yeah, it's definitely a really noticeable difference. All I can say is that we have to, like, keep working on this. And of course, like, changing habits, choosing bicycle instead of your car.
So progress.
Yes, definitely. And I really think that Mexico should be a global example of policies to improve air quality in one of the largest cities of the world.
That's Sam Jones, global development reporter for Britain's Guardian newspaper. You can read his coverage in the paper and online at theguardian.com. And you can hear more of his reporting on the paper's Global Development podcast. It's also on the website at theguardian.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, our special report as the grandson of French oceanographer Jacques Cousteau returns to dry land after spending a record 31 days at an underwater laboratory off the coast of Florida. That's Thursday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.